Law
18.
Common Sense.
Questions.
Questions and Answers.
Question 1.
During the taking of kicks from the penalty mark, to decide the outcome of a drawn match, a penalty taker who was just placing the ball on the mark before taking his kick is seen to be not wearing his shin guards. The referee either did not see this, or he just ignored the fact. It was then noticed that some of the kicker's colleagues had also discarded their shin guards in the center circle. What action should the referee take? Should he caution every player who takes a penalty kick without wearing his or her shin guards? After all, Laws 4 states that players must wear shin guards covered by stockings. Answer 1. The referee would be in his rights to caution the player before he takes the kick and to ask him to put his shin guards back on properly. This would ensure that his colleagues get the message and follow suit. If the player takes the penalty and a goal is scored, the referee could ask the player to take the kick again because the player has infringed Law 4. The penalty kick Law 14 states that the player taking the penalty kick infringes the laws of the game. The referee allows the kick to proceed. If the ball enters the goal, the kick is retaken. The referee could also ask the player to leave the field of play to correct their attire and allow re-entry during the next stoppage. But the players taking the penalty kick are supposed to remain on the field of play. Phew, let's have a bit of common sense here. At the very top levels of football, one would hope that the players and managers know how to behave themselves properly, and that this situation should never happen. At the lower level, where most of the referees officiate, get real. The not wearing of shin guards during the taking of penalty kicks from the penalty mark will have no effect at all. No effect at all. Let them get on with it. After all, the Law 4 stipulation about wearing shin guards is there to prevent players getting broken legs, and this has nothing to do with taking penalty kicks, unless of course the ball is hit so hard that it rebounds back off the crossbar, hits the kicker's shin, and breaks his leg. Question 2. On arrival at a field of play, the grass was found to be overgrowing. There were also some deep ruts in the muddy ground. The players and the team managers have already made a pitch inspection and have agreed between themselves that they would be happy to play the match. The referee carefully inspects the field of play and decides that it is not safe or fit for play. The players and the team managers, all who have traveled some distance, angrily approach the referee to remonstrate about the cancelled game. Is the referee correct to go against everyone else's view, especially as he gets paid, whether the match is played or not? Answer 2. If the referee had allowed the match to be played on an unsafe field, he would have been accepting responsibility for the condition of the field and for any injuries incurred as a result of those field deficiencies, even though all those concerned said they were prepared to accept the consequences of any accident. The referee has a duty to closely inspect the condition of the pitch. Before every game, the referee must always consider the safety of the players. If the referee has any doubt as to the safety of the players because of the field of play deficiencies, then he should not allow the match to take place. It can be very difficult for the referee to go against others' wishes. Common sense advises that referees should rely on their intuition. It is usually blatantly obvious when a field condition is dangerous. Players and managers are always very friendly when they want something, but they can turn monstrously dangerous in an instance if one of their key players suddenly breaks an ankle because of stepping into a deep rut. Question 3. Following a foul tackle on an opponent, the referee was seen to be running alongside the perpetrator, giving him a quiet lecture about something or other. The player had obviously breached Law 12, and a free kick should have been awarded. Why did the referee not take the required action by awarding a free kick to the opposition, and why did he not caution the perpetrator? Answer 3. Law 18 Common sense comes into its own during situations like this. Experienced referees will very often have what is called a quiet word with a player who has committed a minor, niggling foul. This allows the referee to warn the player as to his future conduct and allows the game to keep flowing whilst letting the offender and everyone else see that the referee has noticed the offense and that he is aware of what is going on. The referee is not advised to threaten the perpetrator with a caution at the next offense. It is better to just warn the offender about his behavior. If the referee threatens the offender with a caution next time, then the referee must adhere to this threat and definitely caution the player next time round. Should the next offense be a very, very minor one, this does not leave the referee with any leeway but to caution the player. Besides, it's not gentlemanly for a referee to threaten players with disciplinary action under such circumstances. Question 4. A goalkeeper who has gained possession of the ball in his hands does not release the ball until 6 seconds. Law 12 states that the goalkeeper must release the ball within 6 seconds after gaining possession. Why doesn't the referee award the opposing team an indirect free kick? Answer 4. This is another one of those instances where if the referee rigidly applies the law, in every case, the spirit of the game would be the real loser. The idea of the 6-second stipulation is to prevent the goalkeeper from time-wasting by unduly keeping possession of the ball. So long as the referee is satisfied that the goalkeeper was not deliberately wasting time and seeking to gain an unfair advantage, play should be allowed to continue. The saving grace here is that the referee is the sole authority regarding timekeeping, so who is to say that the goalkeeper took 5.5, 5.75, or even 7 seconds before the ball was released? Question 5. The assistant referee raised his flag to indicate that an attacker was in a clearly offside position in the penalty area. The ball carries on through safely to the defending goalkeeper. The referee acknowledges and overrules the assistant referee by raising his arm and allows play to continue without a stoppage. Why didn't the referee award the defending team an indirect, offside, free kick? Answer 5. Experienced referees will always try to keep the play action flowing continuously when an offending team broaches a law by committing a minor offense, and the ensuing action enables the opposing team to gain a better advantage by continuing play, rather than stopping play to award them a free kick for the offense committed against them. Because the ball had gone straight on through to the goalkeeper, who is known to have a good kick when releasing the ball from his hands, the referee deemed that it would be more beneficial for the goalkeeper's team to continue play by allowing the goalkeeper to distribute the ball to his colleagues, rather than award an indirect free kick for offside. There was little to be gained by awarding an indirect free kick in this instance. Common sense applied by the referee, in this case, allows the goalkeeper to punt the ball back upfield or to distribute as he chooses to continue the game with the minimum of delay. In this instance, the referee has used Law 18 common sense to acknowledge that the assistant referee's signal was correct, but that the referee had decided that the defending team goalkeeper, who had safely gathered the ball in his arms, would benefit more by allowing play to continue than from stopping play to award the defending team an indirect free kick for a correct offside decision. This action taken by the referee allows the play to flow and is respected by both the players and the spectators. In this instance, the referee would also have been correct if he had awarded an offside, because the assistant referee correctly indicated that the player was clearly offside. In other words, the player was either interfering with play, or interfering with an opponent, or gaining an advantage by being in that position. Offside is based on the changing relative positions of players and the ball. It is important to judge offside when the ball is actually played, and not when it is received. A referee will need to take into account the moment the ball was played, who played it, the position of the players at that moment, and whether there was any involvement in active play. It can be very difficult for a referee alone to obtain a perfect viewpoint to judge offside. It is impossible for a referee to have a sidelong view of every offside decision. The assistant referee and to some extent the assistant club linesman will assist the referee in making his decision. It is important to understand what is meant by active play. Active play is when a player has received the ball in an offside position and is interfering with play, or interfering with an opponent, or gaining an advantage by being in that position. Each referee has their own interpretation of exactly what the area of active play actually is. Some referees believe that any attacker in an offside position, whether they receive the ball or not, who are standing in the middle, center, of the pitch near the vicinity of the penalty area, is deemed to be interfering with play, irrespective of the position of defenders or the ball. Other referees will ignore those players if they do not actually receive the ball, or when one of their attacking colleagues runs in from a non-offside position to play the ball. The solution is in defining whether any attacking player is interfering with play, or interfering with an opponent, or has gained an advantage by being in that position. Easy, isn't it? There are many diagrams available to explain whether a player is offside or not. Diagrams are the best way of understanding the offside law? New referees will take some time to build up confidence when dealing with offsides, particularly as they will invariably not have the services of qualified assistant referees in their early matches. The most important advice to new referees is to be very positive when blowing for offsides, and do not worry too much about whether you have made the right decision or not. This will come with time and experience. To stop any whining players, always blow the whistle very loud and long. This drowns out the moans and groans from the players, and lets them know that you mean business, and that you will not be changing your mind. The one part of the offside law that is not fully understood is interfering with an opponent. If an attacker purposefully stands still alongside a defender, because he knows that he is in an offside position, that attacker is actually interfering with that opponent. It could be argued that the defending opponent is marking the attacker, and thus not able to challenge any other attacker who may threaten the goal. If an offside is near the halfway line, and the ball travels safely on through to the defending goalkeeper, then it is more beneficial to the defending team to award an indirect free kick near the halfway line, rather than allow the goalkeeper to continue play by kicking the ball out of his hands from inside his penalty area. Remember these words when giving offside. In the opinion of the referee. In other words, whatever anyone else says during a game, you, the referee, make the offside decision, and nobody else. Question 6. During the taking of a throw-in, in front of the technical area, it was noticed that the referee allowed the player take it about 3 meters from the spot where the ball went out over the touchline. Later on in the game, the referee was seen to be very particular about players taking throw-ins from the exact place where the ball had left the field of play. Why is the referee so inconsistent? Answer 6. Most referees allow some latitude on the exact positioning of throw-ins, especially if the location is away from the goals and near the middle of the field. This allows the ball to be thrown back into play as quickly as possible. Players are usually receptive to this type of common sense and are less interested in adhering strictly to the law about exact positioning. Players do not often argue over such action. This demonstrates a good sportsmanship that will normally have little or no effect on the result of the match. If the throw-in is in such a position that could affect the outcome of a game, for instance, if a team has a good thrower and the throw location is near the corner arc, the referee should ensure that the thrower does not gain an advantage by moving along the touchline to be even nearer to the goal. Some referees are more particular about making players take the throw from the correct position every time, but in my experience, this, along with the finicky positioning of free kicks, is the easiest way for a referee to frustrate players. Comments received about question 6 above. From Colin. As you know, the only point I object to is where you suggest that to make life easy for oneself allow players to cheat at throw-ins and free kicks. I agree that the game flows, but I don't think the referee can afford to be soft in any areas, especially if this shows favoritism. Yes, often it is only one of the teams that appear to win free kicks and slash or throw-ins. If you then leave some, it is hell's own delight to arrange subsequent throws or kicks properly, and players will cheat by a bigger and bigger margin. Thank you for your views, Colin. It's interesting to see another referee's perspective. From Paul. A little pip on the whistle along with the helpful just there please, fellow. Along with lovely or that's far enough. Will help you keep control over the throw-ins and free kicks. Thanks for tip, Paul, about moving players along the touchline during throw-ins and during free kicks. Question 7. At the very end of a game, the red team, who was winning 1-0, was pinned in their own penalty area. The ball remained in play for some time. It was only when the ball was kicked out for a throw-in that the referee finally blew for the end of the game. Why didn't the referee blow for full time when the 90 minutes were up? Answer 7. Most referees like to wait for the ball to be in a relatively neutral area of the field before blowing the final whistle. As soon as the referee has decided that the time added on for stoppages has expired, most referees will wait until the ball is out of the danger area. Referees are very loath to blow the final whistle when the ball is up in the air or on its way toward the goal. The referee is the sole timekeeper, and as such, is the only person who knows exactly what the time is in a game. Referees are strongly advised not to use watches that emit a clear signal after 45 minutes. I would suggest that at the very least, you set your signal to come at 48 minutes instead of 45. This way, players will not argue with you if whilst the ball is on its way into a goal during the last moments of a game, your watch suddenly gives out a loud beeping sound at 45 minutes. You are also advised to take the following action immediately after you blow for the end of each half. Reset your watch, or at least the watch that you have used to stop/start time during the game, to zero time. Players on the losing side have a nasty habit of trying to see what time is showing on your watch. This could lead to arguments about the amount of added time you had allowed in a game. Question 8. Following a challenge for the ball between an attacker and a defender on the edge of the penalty area, the ball was seen to squirm off one of the players and deflects towards a second attacker who was standing in an offside position near the penalty spot. It looked as though both of the players were taking a kick at the ball at the same time whilst making the challenge, and at first, it appears as though the defender may have made contact a fraction of a second before the attacker, but from a distance it looks as though they both made contact with the ball at the same time, causing it to deflect to the offside attacker. Should the referee allow play to continue, or should he penalize the offside attacker for being in an offside position when the ball was deflected, touched, to him? Answer 8. It all depends on the referee's perception and, for want of a better term, his default automatic method navigator, DAMN, because you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. The same goes with throw-ins and corner/goal kicks. These type of decisions are probably the easiest to make, even though they are the hardest to make. This may seem like a contradiction, but let me explain. Firstly, the referee must recognize that there will be many times during each match where it is impossible to make the correct decision. This is due to a number of factors. The speed of play, the distance between the incident and the referee, the fitness of the referee, whether there are players in the referee's line of sight, the shielding of the ball by the player's body, and dare I say it, the referee's eyesight. In situations of this type, the referee can give the decision to the attacking team, or he can give it to the defending team. Some referees automatically give unsure decisions to the defending team. This is how it has been done historically in the past. Some modern referees give unsure decisions to the attacking team, thus embodying a modern movement to give the attackers the advantage, therefore increasing the chances of a goal being scored, which in turn will increase the enjoyment of the spectators. For example, if a referee or an assistant referee is unsure whether an attacker is level or not with the second last defender, then the benefit of the doubt should go to the attacker. Referees are advised to choose which of the two DAMN methods to use when being unsure on which way to give a decision. Of course, the above advice also applies, more so, to the assistant referee. So the answer to the question is Law 18, common sense. There is no answer. It's up to you. The referee should not lose any sleep worrying about whether he has made the correct decision or not during a game. Even if the referee or assistant referee makes the wrong decision, it is the right decision as far as the match is concerned, because he is the only one responsible. Some decisions you win and some you lose. These types of incidents happen in split seconds and referees have to make instant decisions and continue onwards with the game. If a referee shows any weakness or uncertainty when making such decisions, the players, the crowd, and the team officials will certainly make the most of it. Be firm and positive, and accept that you will make genuine mistakes that are not made by you on purpose. See the decision-making page on this website for in-depth advice covering decision-making. And a very good point emailed to me by a referee colleague, Paul Faulkner, from Essex. For offsides, regardless of whether you will give the benefit of doubt to the defense or attack, always be consistent throughout that game, and when you have made a decision, even if in an instant you think you might have made the wrong one, be positively wrong. Whether a decision is really factually right or factually wrong does not matter. What does matter is that the referee always makes an honest decision, which in that fraction of a decision-making second seemed correct in his opinion at that particular time. Of course, don't forget that the referee can change a decision, but he must do so before play is restarted.